This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 249. Today we speak with Dr. Mark Jones about Puritan theology. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 249. My name is Camden Busey. I'm very excited today to be recording once again. We have a large panel with us today to discuss a great topic. Let me introduce to you our panel. First, we have Jim Cassidy, who is pastor of Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. Welcome back, Jim. It's great to have you.
It's great to be here as always, Camden.
And Jim, of course, is working on a PhD. He is a PhD candidate at Westminster Theological Seminary. Can you provide people a little bit of an update? Are you still writing your dissertation?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I probably will be for a little while, but I'm on chapter 3 and working my way through that now. And my advisor has been wonderfully encouraging to me, so I am hopeful, and things continue to move along in the right direction. I think it's slow, but correct direction, I think.
Well, maybe we'll graduate together. I don't know. I'll try to catch you. Probably not.
I'd be honored.
Probably not. We also have with us Nick Batzig, who is church planter with the PCA. He's at Richmond Hill, just outside of Savannah, Georgia, at New Covenant Presbyterian Church. Welcome back, Nick. It's great to have you on.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be on.
Nick, of course, is heading up the efforts. He is the host of East of Eden, which is our new program on the biblical and systematic theology of Jonathan Edwards. I want to thank you for all of your work, not only your work, but everyone involved, because this program is doing well. And I want to let people know. So thanks, Nick. And what do we have coming up in future episodes?
Thanks, Camden. I think tomorrow we covered Christ's Agony. The episode coming out tomorrow will deal with Edwards' sermon, Christ's Agony, which is just one of the most outstanding sermons on Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane. So very excited that's coming out. And we're working to make the quality better of our recordings. We're trying to tighten everything up. We've got several good interviews coming out. We interviewed Sean Lucas with regard to his new book on the theology of Jonathan Edwards. That'll be out in maybe 6 weeks or so. And then we plan on interviewing. We have kind of set up an interview with Kyle Strobel, Lee Strobel's son, who is a professor, seminary professor, and has done extensive work in Jonathan Edwards. So we're excited about that. We're trying to get R.C. Sproul. I think we're going to be able to nail him down here soon to come and talk about Gerstner and his work with Edwards and all of that, and Sproul's interest. And so we're excited about the future of the show and hope that it'll be a benefit to people.
Yeah. That Christ's Agony will be, I think, two episodes behind by the time this episode airs. But that usually comes out on Tuesday mornings. So stay tuned at reformforum.org for more episodes of East of Eden. I also want to mention that we have with us today Jared Oliphant, who is communications manager for Westminster Theological Seminary. He is working out of Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome back, Jared. It's great to have you on.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be back.
And that rounds out our panel, which we have a great group that are going to be asking questions of our superb guest and this great topic we have with us today, Dr. Mark Jones, who is the minister of Faith Presbyterian Church, which is a PCA church in Vancouver, British Columbia. He's also the research associate in the Faculty of Theology at the University of the Free State, Bloemfontein, if I got that right, in South Africa. Welcome back to the program, Mark. It's great to have you on again.
Thanks very much, guys. It's always a pleasure to talk theology with you guys.
We're delighted to have you. Mark joins us today to talk about his new book from Reformation Heritage Books. He co-wrote it with Joel Beakey, titled A Puritan Theology, Doctrine for Life. So you got the same subtitle as our little podcast here, but this is a magisterial book, really, a one volume, but a very thorough and important title that we're going to talk about in a moment. But before we get there, do we have any news or bits of information we need to mention before we get started?
Yeah, sure. I'll give my usual plugs just to keep us going and keep it on the radar for our listeners. But
sure.
We do have coming up here pretty soon in November. We're going to have the conference. The Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals is going to have a conference in our area in Princeton called the title is On Sanctification. So we're looking forward to that. Check out the Alliance's website to get more information on that if you live either in or around Princeton. The 2 weeks actually before that, we have here at it's 1 week before, conference at our church in Ringo's with Doctors Tipton and Poitras on the historical Adam called Adam and the Bible. History and faithful biblical interpretation. So check out our website, calvary-amwell.org, to find out more information about that conference.
Great. Jared or Nick, anything great. Else?
No, I wish I was up there. I wish I was close enough to those because they sound good.
Me too. All right.
Yeah. Just one. I mentioned, I think in the previous episode, there's a Together for Adoption conference actually at Southern Seminary in Louisville, October 4th and 5th that I'll be at. Dave Garner will be speaking there, but alongside him, Sinclair Ferguson, Mike Horton, Fred Sanders, Russell Moore, Dan Kruver, who heads up Together for Adoption. So looking forward to that.
Great. A lot of things going on. Of course, it's that time of year. A lot of conferences and opportunities to discuss theology and to meet with one another. So stay tuned at reformedforum.org for news and updates about what's going on. And you'll be up to date and ready to listen. All right. Well, I suppose before we get into this new book, A Puritan Theology, Doctrine for Life, we do. I'd like to get an update from Mark. Could you tell us a little bit about your current project and let us know where it's headed?
Sure. I'm pretty heavy into writing a book on antinomianism. It's going to be not just a historical theological work, but also with exegetical and systematic type concerns. So I'm basically chapter 5 of 8 chapters, and they're pretty much research, so it's a case of just putting them together. And so far the feedback's been very positive, and a number of different professors from seminaries have said how much a book like this is needed in order to understand just what historically antinomianism was and how it may relate to present-day concerns that are out there in the reformed and broader evangelical world.
Mm-hmm. And could you also tell us a little bit about the website, meetthepuritans.com?
Well, that is a website with a few friends who are some very good scholars, actually. So if you have a chance, I wish Marty Ford would write a bit more, but he's just actually in a waiting period for his PhD dissertation on the gospel and law gospel issues from around 1200 to mid 1500s or 1585. And I think Carl Truman's one of the examiners.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, well, he was quite nice to me, so I'm sure he'll be equally nice to Marty. So that's going to be a very important work. And Marty's also got an article coming out on Calvin and the law gospel issue. And I think it could shed some good light. So he writes, Lee Gatiss writes some really good stuff. Danny Hyde, and we have Ryan McGraw. So we have a number of guys who are published in. And Ryan's actually just finished his PhD on John Owen and worship under my supervision, and Adrian Naylor at the Edwards Center at Yale through Bloemfontein. So hopefully he'll be Dr. McGraw soon. So
oh, wow.
To that, yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. And I do also want to mention, related to this, speaking of academics here, that Mark's PhD was from Leiden University, and his dissertation was titled Why Heaven Kissed Earth, the Christology of the Puritan Reformed Orthodox Theologian Thomas Goodwin. So we definitely have an expert with us today. So visit the website meetthepuritans.com for more of those and more information and writing about the Puritans. But we have on hand a fantastic discussion ready on this new title, A Puritan Theology, Doctrine for Life. Before we open its pages and start to discuss what's actually in the book, I think we might need to address the initial problem of defining Puritan. Could you describe for us how we go about understanding what a Puritan is? And that might help us to learn where the boundary markers are for this particular book.
Well, in the introduction, Joel and I are sensitive to the fact that it's almost impossible in one sense to define who is a Puritan. And then when you join it with Puritan theology, it becomes even more problematic, right? Because it's a more of a historical phenomenon and not a really a theological way of defining someone's theology. So I make the point rather forcefully that Jonathan Edwards wasn't a Puritan in the historical sense of the word. I think he was, greater theologian than most of the Puritans, but that's not to make him a Puritan. And same with Spurgeon, and then you get Lloyd Jones and Packer, and it just spirals out of control, so that anyone who likes the Puritans could be a Puritan. So it's a historically located term. Joel and I have, had a bit of a discussion on when we think Puritanism ended, and I think in the introduction you can tell that we're not going to be overly dogmatic. I tend to end Puritanism quite early. He's a bit later, but I think definitely by the towards the end of the 17th century, Puritanism in England definitely is over, and you've got Protestant nonconformity. So are most Puritans Calvinists? Yes, but there were Puritans who weren't Calvinists. They were kind of Arminian. You have some who had some very idiosyncratic views and the like. So it's really... probably the way I describe Puritanism to most people is an attempt to reform the Church of England in consistency with reformed principles of worship. And once they were unable to reform the Church of England after 1662, Puritanism essentially starts to die a slow death. Hmm.
Now, even within that definition and those boundary markers, there are any number of theologians that we can speak of, and we have a single volume here in front of us, and you're attempting to do a very honorable thing, but a very difficult thing as well. How did you go about whittling down the people that you've included?
It was kind of one of those things where you acknowledge that I haven't read every Puritan. I still talk to friends of mine who bring up names, and I have to go, who are you talking about? And they've written volumes, and you just think, wow, this is incredible. I know other published experts, I can give you lots of stories, and someone's brought their name up and they've said the same thing. So maybe that's just a sign of the amount of literature in that period is just simply overwhelming.
Yeah.
So I stuck to trying to be as expansive as I'm able, but at the same time, people will see very quickly that I'm really quite comfortable with several theologians, such as, of course, Goodwin, Owen, Rutherford, Manton, Burgess, and those types of guys. So you get the main Puritans and what they thought, but there's lots of guys that you'll see come into play in various paragraphs and essays as well.
Mm. Can you speak a little bit about the place of this volume in relation to other Puritan theologies? What other books are available, and why have you gone to such lengths? We appreciate that you've gone to such lengths, but can you describe the reason behind putting this book together?
Well, I think it's probably the only unified systematic theology to have been written on the Puritans. You have some very excellent works, especially by J.I. Packer, The Quest for Godliness. But even that's somewhat narrowly focused. You have his Puritan Papers. There are other substantial works on aspects of Puritan doctrine, such as Jeffrey Nuttall's The Holy Spirit, Ernest Kevin, The Grace of Law, things like that. But nothing really brings together the whole systematic focus of Puritan theology. So that was really what Joel and I were attempting to do, is give someone a systematic theology on Puritan theology.
Mark, I particularly found your chapter on the hermeneutics and exegesis of the Puritans helpful. I think it's chapter 2, and how you and Dr. Beakey deal especially with the covenantal hermeneutic of the Puritans and then the Christological principle of the Puritans. And you and I have talked at length about the covenants in Puritan theology, and there's a spectrum, and you and I don't actually wouldn't agree on every little detail completely, but your chapter is so very helpful. I'm presently reading through Kingdom Through Covenant, which has gotten a whole lot of attention in the broader Calvinistic world, and I wish I could take your section on the covenants, the two covenants, Covenant of Works, Covenant of Grace, and just send it to everybody reading Kingdom Through Covenant so that they could get a historical, a careful historical treatment of why so many of our Reformed forefathers and the Puritans adopted that as a hermeneutical structure. Could you talk a little bit about Covenant of Works, Covenant of Grace, and why that's so important in the Puritan hermeneutic?
Yeah, absolutely. And readers will have to, as they buy the book, look at the beginning of the book. It displays which chapters are written by myself and which chapters are written by Joel, mm-hmm. and which mm-hmm. chapters we had help on. And there's a few chapters each of us had some help on, which really added to the merit of the chapters. And so this chapter was written by myself exclusively. And what I found was that it was necessary for this type of thing to be able to set the context for later chapters on covenant theology. And so I from what little I've read of Kingdom Through, is it Kingdom Through Covenant?
Right.
Yeah. I found that perhaps their treatment of Reformed historical theology was quite limited to one or two theologians mainly.
Right.
And I wasn't so convinced of their reading of just the history of how Reformed theologians have been sensitive to each covenant over the various dispensations of God's dealings with his people. So what I show in later chapters, for example, on Sinai are differing views, and there's several differing views. The covenant of works, I aim to show that it was a highly complex theological discussion involved. Right. And so it's no good simply just saying, well, do you believe in a covenant of works that Adam had to obey? There were a number of issues like the nature of Adam's obedience, the power of the Spirit, his reward or lack thereof. All of those topics were crucial to the rest of how they understood Scripture. And then the covenant of grace, I went through each of the historical covenants and showed that some saw the Noahic covenant as part of the covenant of grace. And there are some people today who would disagree with that. But there's quite a bit of diversity and unity on these topics, and I at least hope that people will see that. I didn't really make my own opinions known, I hope, on which was right or wrong. I just wanted people to see the diversity among Reformed theologians.
That's helpful.
Yeah, and that's so helpful, because I often hear guys say, well, we're not covenant theologians. And when I hear that now, and partly my own study of the Puritans, partly our conversations, my reading some of your other work and what you have here, it's so helpful that there is a spectrum, that even though the Puritan theology is by and large covenantal, and the majority of them probably do adopt covenant of works, covenant of grace structure, there is diversity. And that really makes me want to study more carefully and think more carefully and not just make blanket statements too. So I found that to be very helpful.
Yeah. The one other thing I would say is even in the covenant of works, someone like Goodwin is writing the covenant of works, and you see that they had a Christological focus, not only on the order of decrees, not only on their Christology and soteriology, but even in the covenant of works, you can see how Christology and mm-hmm. biblical interpretation and hermeneutics and all of those things are so Christologically focused that as some have even accused the Puritans of lacking Calvin's Christocentric focus is just plain nuts.
Oh, man.
Right, right.
What?
It's almost a hyper-pietism. And that's another thing I really appreciated about this chapter, Mark, is that I have gleaned so much of my own Christology and even biblical theology from reading the Puritans over the years.
Oh, yeah.
And I hear so many people saying the Puritans were concerned about application. And it's like, well, yeah, obviously they were. But they were concerned about hermeneutics and exegesis and Christology. And so I think your chapter is very, very helpful in that regard.
Thank you.
Now, Mark, well, one thing that some readers may be very surprised at is a comment that Sinclair Ferguson makes in the foreword. There he mentions Richard Barcellus's claim that John Owen matches or maybe even surpasses Gerhardus Voss as a biblical theologian. On that note, what might this actually say for the English Puritans in their understanding of theology?
Well, I can assure you of a few things in life. That I am no Voss expert is one of those things I can assure you, but I have read his biblical theology, and you know, it's hard for me to make comparisons between someone like Voss and Owen. I almost just don't think it's wise. I'm not criticizing Ferguson for even saying that, but
yeah,
to me, it's. I think maybe the best way for me to put it would to say that. Learn Latin, read Owen's Theologumena, and you'll see a different approach than Voss, but not a contrary approach, if that makes sense.
Oh, sure.
And what you find Owen's, one of the major themes dominating his discussion is not only the unfolding of the history of Revelation and the way in which God adds and adds over the ages, but the doxological praise that permeates his work and the focus on worship. And you'll find Owen writing with high scholastic terminology and then breaking out into doxology in the middle of his work. And perhaps Voss does that, I don't know, but that's something that you'll find in Puritan theology where it's almost like that's just acceptable, whereas people would write a book of that nature today, and if you were to break out in doxology, people would think you've lost the plot and gone mad.
Well, the theological sciences were more wed together, I think it would be fair to say, in the Puritan writings, whereas Voss would be taking a distinct branch of theology
and
focusing in. And so I think that's a fair statement, though, Mark, that you know you do find a more of a robust exposition in the Puritans than you would find in a lot of modern theologians who are writing on one, you know, one loci of theology.
Mm. It seems as if that provides kind of a backbone or a unifying feature to the theological encyclopedia for many of these Puritans. Would you say that that's fair? And they're bound together and focused upon Christ as center and on this doxological view?
Yeah, for them, you know, one of the things why I think people find Puritan theology has this lot of that application and weds together what we would call spirituality, perhaps we'd call that today, and theology, was just because of their historical situation. They were attempting to reform the church. They were churchmen. They were pastors. They cared about the church deeply. And so everything they wrote was for the church. Not for journals per se, not for academic publishers where, you know, if 10, 15 people actually read my book, I would be surprised. They weren't doing that type of writing. So when you look at their history, you find that they actually had to write in that way because of what they're attempting to do.
I'm just wondering if maybe you could tackle the question of the doctrine of limited atonement. Obviously, Owen, his death of death, right? But you've also got other Puritans in there. What is the discussion like on the doctrine of limited atonement among the Puritans? Was there debate? Were there nuances? Maybe you can fill us in a little bit on the historical detail.
Well, I did, in fact, ask Joel if I could write a chapter on hypothetical universalism, and we decided that we just couldn't, shouldn't, or wouldn't. I don't know which one. And that, you know, we had to basically choose. There were, you know, another 20, 30 chapters we could have easily written, but you have to cull it somewhere.
There's already 60 some, I think.
Yeah, 60. So 60. And books started getting more expensive the more chapters you had. So, you know, I didn't really have a chance to go into that in too much depth, but I, you know, it's something I've done quite a bit of reading on lately, and have I supervised an MTH paper at RTS, a friend who's rethinking the significance of hypothetical universalism at Westminster. And there's a debate. I have several friends, Jonathan Moore, Lee Gatiss, who've written on that. And the old sort of paradigm was that, you know, basically they were almost heretical. Muller came in and showed there was a difference between Amiraldianism and hypothetical universalism. And then you have non-speculative and speculative, and it gets really confusing. So that's all to say you won't find much in the book that deals in depth with that. But on limited atonement, you know, certainly most of the Reformed Puritans held to particular redemption. The criticism of hypothetical universalism is that Christ died for everybody on condition they would believe, a condition that God never intended to give them in the first place. So it doesn't really remove the obstacles that they were trying to overcome, and that was over the free offer and those types of things. And there's other books coming out, and friends of mine who've accused Owen of not even being able to have a free offer and basically being a hyper-Calvinist. So it's at a point in time right now in historiography where I don't think the final word has been said, and it certainly hasn't been said in this book, so I can't really say much more.
Mark, just out of interest, I know that Edward Griffith, the 19th century pastor that Banner of Truth published his 2-volume, he was Amiraldian. I know there were others that have been broadly would be considered falling within the Reform camp. And I know Muller makes an argument for Amiraldianism being an acceptable view to some extent. Were there any Puritans that would have been classified as Amiraldian? I know Amirault lived, you know, in the 17th century. Would any of them have adopted that position?
You know, I'm just trying to do a quick search in my brain right now, and I think that you'll find there's definitely a number of Puritans who were hypothetical universalists, and the reason is Amiraldianism really was an issue where you have the decrees end up getting really messed up. And, I'm trying to think, I know that after the show's done, I'm going to come up.
It's okay. I know that I was throwing that at you, but I appreciate it.
You know, I would say just briefly that you can be a Reformed theologian and hold to hypothetical universalism. That's not really a debate. The debate is whether the Westminster standards allow for hypothetical universalism. And I know, having talked with Richard Muller about this, he thinks that hypothetical universalism could fit within the standards. So does Jonathan Moore and Lee Gatiss. I have a friend who is arguing against that, and it's actually been quite persuasive so far. Mm-hmm. But Amiraldianism, I do not think could fit with the Westminster Confession.
I don't think so either.
Yeah, yeah. I don't either.
Muller actually addresses this. I just got the pre-pub galley of it, but he addresses it in his upcoming work, Calvin and the Reformed Tradition. I don't know how extensively, but I just saw that it was in there, so maybe look for that on the topic.
Yeah, when that book's available. Interesting. Another subject that's increasingly significant, you touch on in chapter 8 with Thomas Goodwin and Johannes Macovius on justification from eternity. What's going on there, and what do we need to address in terms of thinking about justification in time and as relating to the decrees, for instance?
Well, that was a chapter written by my friend and I, Gert van den Brink, and he has got... he's so smart that it's hard for me to talk about it, actually. I have these friends in Europe, and I sit down with them and find out they know like 8 languages, and then I just think, why am I even bothering? So in relation to the chapter, I had written on Goodwin and realized that a lot of the old thought out there was that justification from eternity was an antinomian tenet. which is not in fact the case. And even someone like Tobias Crisp didn't hold to justification from eternity. People had also argued, and what's interesting to me is you look at someone like John Gill and other theologians trying to defend their view, and they appeal to theologians before them. So what we do today by appealing to theologians over history is what has always taken place. And someone like John Gill held that Macovius believed in justification from eternity. Well, what our essay shows is that is just bad historical theology by John Gill. I think that Thomas Boston makes some mistakes in his historical theology. And so the main issue for Goodwin is whether the elect are under God's wrath before they come to faith. And the answer for him is yes. So he has a justification from eternity, justification at the cross, and then justification that's more existential when the believer comes to faith. And the key for Goodwin is that they are not justified until they believe in foro conscientiae. So that's in their conscience. So that's key for Goodwin, which separates him from the antinomians. The antinomians believed you were justified often from birth and were never under God's wrath. Macovius is a little bit different from that. Justification for him takes place at the first promise in Genesis 3:15. So, and then of course it has to be applied to the conscience. So it shows that Goodwin was different from Macovius, and Goodwin was different from Owen, and Macovius was different from Owen, and Macovius and Goodwin were different from the antinomians, which shows there are a lot of differences.
How does this relate to the covenant of redemption, for instance? We have this, the Pactum Salutis. How do the merits of Christ, his coming work, this idea of justification from eternity that some people propose, how does that relate to the covenant of redemption?
Well, it's quite tricky because you're relating the decree to what ends up taking place in history, and there's no question that when you're talking about Goodwin talks actually about the covenant of redemption, and he understands the covenant of redemption as the means that God will use to accomplish his ends. And so he's a superlapsarian in his order of the decrees. But when he talks about the covenant of redemption in eternity, he talks in infralapsarian terms. And then whatever is true in eternity ends up becoming true in time. So I think that the covenant of redemption is absolutely crucial for your doctrine of the atonement, for example. If you hold to particular redemption, that will necessarily have an impact on how you understand the decrees. But, you know, I don't know if I've answered what exactly. No.
It's just an interesting topic when we start to relate the two. I'm just curious what the Puritans might have said and how they relate the work of Christ that he, well, the work of the Son of God as he agreed to do in eternity, to how that pertains to his actually accomplishing the redemption and how it's applied to individual believers in history. So,
Mark, I particularly found the chapter on the Puritans on Providence helpful, and I saw in the one of the prefaces that Sinclair Ferguson had helped Joel Beakey write this chapter. Given him some help with that. Could you talk to our listeners a little bit about the significance of the doctrine of providence in Puritan theology, specifically as the chapter talks about their historical context with, you know, living in an agrarian culture, childbirth, sickness, plagues, fire, war, all of those things, and how that plays into so many of their writings and why that's an important doctrine?
Yeah, this might sound a little bit odd, but I'm actually looking forward to reading this book.
It's a massive book, so I understand.
No, but in the sense that, you know, when you're writing books, you're actually so into like writing and editing and sending it off, and then Joel's sending me chapters, I'm sending him chapters, and you're looking for all of these different issues, but you're not able to enjoy the book. I think you've hit it on the head. Is their historical context providence for them was a way in which it was absolutely a pastoral doctrine, not simply a scholastic, how do we discuss this? And so when Owen loses, 9 children, how does that relate to his doctrine of providence? If there's no providence, then it really leads him to complete despair. So, I'm looking forward to reading that chapter. That's all I can say.
I guess I find it interesting. You think about the crook in the lot, and what is the one about the mute rod, being mute under the rod of God? I forget which Puritan wrote that. But there's all these Puritan treatises and writings that are dealing with God's providence in all of these various things, and it seems like kind of an all-embracing applicatory doctrine to their lives that maybe we don't hear about so much in our society, I guess, because we get sick, we go to the doctor, we get a terminal illness or what we think might be, and then there's a cure. And as you've pointed out with Owen and so many others, that they suffered great losses. And it's really amazing to me that how much they clung to a verse like Romans 8:28. We know that all things work together for the good of those that love God, that are called according to his purpose, because, you know, these are people, humanly speaking, these are men that ought to be questioning the goodness of God. And yet they're not in the face of all that. I just think that's a very pervasive theme in Puritan writings because of their context.
Yeah.
Mark, just unless someone wants to follow up on that, just have a question about a couple other chapters. Noticing just chapter 18, the Minority Report, John Owen on Sinai, and then looking 2 chapters later, the Puritans on Law and Gospel. I'm assuming you've done some work on Law and Gospel. We mentioned it earlier. Do you, or how do you relate these 2 chapters, or did you discover anything new when you were writing on this topic that maybe you hadn't before, or what's your approach to the topic?
Well, the Minority Report, John Owen on Sinai, you'll see in the book that there's some chapters that focus on a specific theologian and some where there's a lot of theologians brought in to give you a general picture. And I thought it was really important because of how sensitive this topic is today for some people, to give a very descriptive analysis of one guy on Sinai, namely John Owen, so that you could get into the whole thought behind what he's doing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when you read essays and they're just quoting ad nauseum, ad infinitum, passage after passage from different guys, you can't really get into the whole way they're thinking about a topic. Mm-hmm. So Owen's way of looking at Sinai is definitely not the majority view among the Puritans, but it is an acceptable view within Puritanism for sure. And, I just try to show how why he viewed things the way he did and how sophisticated his thought was on this topic and the way in which he relates covenant to testament, covenant of grace to covenant of works. And so that's more of bringing Owen's theology together. The Law and the Gospel, to me, is a really important chapter because it shows really how different the Reformed view of the Law and the Gospel is from, say, a Lutheran view and even an Antinomian view. So it's one thing to say that, you know, do you hold to the Law and the Gospel distinction? Well, it's pretty hard to find people saying no in Protestant scholasticism. The question is, what does that mean? And I think my chapter shows that for the Puritans, the Gospel isn't just simply an indicative, and the Law, while being an imperative, can fit within the context of the Gospel. So Owen will talk about the prescriptive part of the Gospel, which to some people, that's nuts. That's commonplace talk among Puritans, is that the Gospel, when Christ preached the Sermon on the Mount, he's preaching the Gospel in their view. So their concept of the Gospel was quite large. Rutherford, for example, says the chief issue with the Antinomians was our differences of the Law and the Gospel. And the Antinomians said the Gospel persuades, whereas the Orthodox said that the Gospel also commands as well as promises.
Mm-hmm. One thing that piqued my interest here is chapter 17, which I see that you've written as well. The Puritans on the Old and New Covenants, a gracious Moses? How, in what way can the Puritans, or do the Puritans speak about Moses being gracious, or at least that administration including grace. That would be another contentious subject in the present discussion, I think.
Well, they didn't have Mendenhall's research to divide them up. law covenants and promise covenants. So maybe they're working at a disadvantage, or some would say perhaps an advantage. But, you know, it's clear that most of the Puritans and the Westminster Confession, I believe that the administration made with Moses was part of the covenant of grace. And so it was a gracious covenant that had a heightened legal obligation. Nobody denies that. Even those who hold to a really strong form of a covenant of grace and Moses. But certainly they held to the view it was part of the covenant of grace and not in opposition with the Abrahamic covenant.
Now, to be fair, though, there were those like Perkins, I think, in his commentary on Galatians, and there are many other Puritans who will use the language of covenantal works with regard to the Mosaic Covenant in some sense that seems to maybe parallel what you find in Marrow theology. Would you say that's a fair statement? Though I'm not saying it's the majority view. There were those who will speak of the Mosaic Covenant in that way, right?
Yeah, like I said, that's why I gave a chapter to Owen's discussion, because right. There you have probably the greatest Puritan mind who's taking that minority view.
Right.
The chapter on a gracious Moses actually highlights the different views within Puritanism. So it's not just a case of they all say this, but mm-hmm. a lot say this, some say that. But no one that I would have read has ever, made a formal one-to-one relation between the covenant of works and Sinai. That's simply just not in them. They may use language borrowed from the covenant of works, so the moral law from the covenant of works in that sense. And I think I make the distinction between formal and material republication and those types of things. So right. I'm trying to show we should be nuanced in the way we say the Sinai covenant is a covenant of works. You can't just say that without qualifying it in and saying, what do you mean by that? So these chapters aim to show how we can speak about that and how we should refrain from it.
Absolutely. Chapter 19 is very pertinent to this discussion, covenant conditions. Could you tell the listeners a little bit about why the discussion on covenant conditions and how is important and how the Puritans kind of dealt with that and why they talk and write extensively about covenant conditions?
Yeah, the covenant of covenant conditions chapter is one of the areas where you probably see the way in which Puritans are having to deal with competing errors and heresies. So you have a Roman Catholic type of conditions where good works, spirit wrought good works, become a condition for final salvation. You have Arminians talking about conditions of faith necessary for receiving forgiveness. Then you have antinomians getting rid of conditions altogether so that, basically it's justification and an epistemological understanding that you're justified. And so what they're having to do is tread carefully between all of these competing errors and heresies to come up with a way in which they may speak of faith as a condition. So Flavel, for example, affirms that faith is a condition for receiving justification, and it's an antecedent condition, so that faith is required before someone can be justified. And this has a lot of connection with union with Christ debates as well. But then you have something like the condition of good works. Well, that would be a consequent condition, not an antecedent condition.
Right.
So I think the Puritans did an excellent job of talking about how the covenant is sort of unconditional and conditional, and mm-hmm. why they needed the distinctions they did to be able to speak in both ways and arrive at a good way of staying away from errors on either side of them.
You really see this, I think, too, when you read somebody like Turretin, and he's got a whole section on covenant conditions. And I think Mark Beach, professor at Mid-America Reformed, wrote a doctoral dissertation on Turretin on the Covenant, and specifically deals in there with the conditionality aspect. And I mean, it's almost lifted straight out of the work of the Puritans. So even the post-Reformation Reformed scholastics are building on the English Puritans and the things you've highlighted. So I think that's a very helpful chapter too.
Good.
Now, of course, we've been speaking a lot about the work of Christ, and it's implicit in much of this discussion. Can you give us some high points on Christology in terms of the subjects and the people that you're addressing in this book?
The chapter on Puritan Christology, I'm just trying to remember which one it is. It's in the Christology section.
Yeah, 21.
Mm-hmm. 21, okay. Puritan Christology, that is one of my favorite chapters in the book because I wrote it and
at least you're honest.
Yeah. Just trying to be honest. Yeah. Cause I wrote it, but it's one of my favorite subjects, of course, cause I did my PhD on Goodwin's Christology. But when it comes to Christology, John Owen ascends higher than any theologian I've ever read on the topic. And I'm not overstating that. That's my own view. And the reason I wanted to do one on Puritan Christology is I think Owen makes a unique contribution that you find in the works of Sibbes and Goodwin, for example. And Richard Sibbes has some remarkable stuff on how the Ordo Salutis is in Christ before the Ordo Salutis is in us and stuff like that. But the key to Puritan Christology is actually their pneumatology. And Owen relates Christ and the Spirit in a way that I hadn't seen any writer discuss. Even Turretin, you know, he talks about it and he's on the same page as Owen, but Owen will go even farther and say things and you're just left astounded. To me, that's a really important chapter because it basically shows how the active obedience of Christ was real obedience, not just him relying on his divine nature. But Owen says the only singular act of his divine nature was the assumption of itself with the human nature. Every other act that Christ did on earth was in the power of the Spirit.
That's most excellent stuff. But I have a question, Mark, about Trinitarian theology among the Puritans, because I ask it. I really don't know, having not studied at length the Puritans on Trinitarian theology. But could you tell us a little bit about their Trinitarian theology? Is there any original type of advancements in terms of Trinitarian theology, or are they simply maintaining the Orthodox line, or is there something new that they contribute to Trinitarianism?
I actually have, well, Nick knows, we all have our strong opinions on certain topics, and I'm quite flabbergasted, to be honest, at Robert Lethem's book, which is an excellent book on the Trinity. It's an award-winning book, but he just skips right over the 17th century, and I'm thinking, I just don't understand that.
That's interesting.
Because they made some remarkable contributions, and I think the chapter will show that, but especially in relating the doctrine of the Trinity to worship, and that's somewhere where Owen was at his best, is corporate worship and the doctrine of the Trinity, communion with God and the doctrine of the Trinity. But also, one area I did quite a bit of research on Goodwin in my book, Why Heaven Kissed Earth, was on the aseity of the Son. And there you even find the Puritans at their best and sometimes at their interpretative worst. So how Calvin relates to the Puritans, they have a different view than Calvin on the aseity of the Son. And where Calvin was quite radical, I believe, in his view on autotheos, the Puritans took a more sort of classic view of generation of essence. So you see something of the intra-reform debates there, but definitely I think the communion topic and the nature of how they related the Trinity to what we would call the external works of the Trinity, how they're indivisible and yet they terminate on certain persons. The Latin would be terminus operationis. So that they're connecting vigorously their Trinitarian theology to the covenant of redemption is the key to that, but how it unfolds in what we would say imminent works of God in eternity, transient works, which are Christ's works of impetration in time, and then the Spirit's works of application. So everything in their theology is Trinitarian, and so I think they've made some very important contributions in that regard.
That's most excellent stuff. Would you be able to open up a little bit more about the way in which Owen, to put it this way, uses the Trinity in terms of developing a Reformed doxology or a Reformed view of worship?
Sure. You know, this is that's what my friend Ryan McGraw has just finished his PhD on, is this very topic, and it's been really a joy to read through the thesis, not least because I didn't realize what a narrow view of worship I had until I read what Owen had to say about the way in which communion with God takes place. And the main point that Owen makes is that communion with the triune God takes place most especially in worship. And so his doctrine of corporate worship is very high, and the way in which the Trinity is revealed to believers, and the necessity of our worship being Trinitarian, so that you can go into lots of churches today and you may be hearing a lot about Christ, but nothing about how the Trinity should form our worship. In terms of just other specific points, there's not as much in the chapter on Owen on that, and so I'm going to just point readers to when the book will be published by Ryan, hopefully soon, and they'll get an excellent look at Owen's doctrine of worship in relation to the Trinity.
Mark, I wanted to get this question in real quick before we're out of time, but you have done work on Goodwin, Beakey's done work on Goodwin, you know, lots of work has been done on Owen. I know Ferguson, I think, did his dissertation on Owen, right, on the Holy Spirit. And then there are those big, substantial Puritan figures who get a lot of focus, Sibbes and all these guys. Are there any Puritans that you've read and studied that you think are just sitting there waiting for guys to come along and do further studies in?
That's a great question.
That is a great question, and I would be happy to put forward a few guys that I think could be excellent case studies for people to look at. Maybe Owen's becoming the new Calvin, and a moratorium needs to be put on working on him, although it's something to the testimony of their theology that dissertations can be written on them, seems like forever and ever, but someone like John Arrowsmith, his Christology and his work on the Gospel of John would be excellent. There's not been a whole lot done on John Ball and how influential he was on the Westminster Divines and his doctrine of faith, his doctrine of the covenant, his ecclesiology.
Right.
That would be an excellent study. You know, guys like Anthony Burgess, there's one or two dissertations out there on him, but still quite a bit of work to be done on guys like Anthony Burgess. I think maybe where I'd like to see something done would be on Stephen Charnock's Doctrine of God. I have a chapter on that in chapter 4 on the attributes of God, but It's basically just an overview, but something really substantial on Charnock would be quite useful. So, and
that's
great.
That's very helpful.
Mark, would you be able? I think we might have even asked you this question last time we had you on. I think we were talking about Goodwin's Christology, but would you be able to give our listeners perhaps some entry points into which people can enter the world of Puritan theology, aside from your book, in terms of getting to the original sources, if a person is interested in picking up and reading good theology? And I know Goodwin's name is going to come up here, but maybe you can give us direct our listeners to some good books to start out with.
Well, it's going to be very unoriginal, but it's I hope will be helpful. The book that I wrote, if you go to the bibliography, you're going to see a massive bibliography that was compiled, and that will be one way. The other thing I would say is to get Owen's works and just start thumbing through them like you would do with Edwards, and you will find nuggets of gold. In Owen's works, volume 3, and he discusses the Holy Spirit, he has a section at the end of the book on holiness. And if we just printed that section in a nice crossway, puffed up, all of that thing, it would be, I think, one of the definitive works on holiness. The problem is it's stuck at the back of a hefty volume and no one is able to get to it. So try and thumb your way through some of the works. The other thing would be to go to Google Books and type in Richard Sibbes and Christ and the Spirit, and you will find some excellent stuff there for free. Google Books is making available so many Puritan resources.
Oh, yeah.
So that, you know, that would be my suggestion. But you know, as I'm reading more and more of the Puritans, and I haven't stopped, I just can't get over how Owen seems to be just on another level than all of the rest of the guys. And so I would stick to him first and then move out into other areas.
One thing I'd like to tie up here is this connection with pastoral ministry. What was the effect of the ministry on the theology of these men? Most of them were actually working in parish ministry. How did that influence them, and why do you think their writings took on the character that they did?
Well, I've always said to young interns, seminary students, and anyone who wants to talk about it, that the best theologians over history have been pastors, in my view. And that's where our best theologians really should be today, because that's where the real theology takes place. I've actually been stumped maybe by Nick a few times, but my daughter actually has the honor of stumping me more than Nick Batzik on a question that I actually didn't know how to answer, really. And so as a pastor, you're dealing with real life issues, and that's what made their theology so good, is that they were in the homes of their parish, their congregations. And it's an interesting comment, actually, that Baxter makes about the nature of the Congregationalists, how when the plague broke out in London, I believe, they were the ones going in and still dealing with their people, ministering to them. And so if you want to write a book on Providence and you've actually gone into your parish homes when there's a plague rippling through the city, it's going to be a lot better than someone who's sitting in an office with their Aquinas Summa and writing it. Now, you know, that's just my view, and I think nothing takes the place of bridging experience and theology.
Oh, yeah.
Mark, I know that, and I'm asking the practical questions for maybe our listeners that have not read, and you've read very extensively the Puritan literature, and this book that you and Dr. Beakey have put together is obviously shows the breadth of y'all's reading. Who would you set somebody off on? And I maybe have asked this to you in previous interviews, but if somebody's listening to this show right now and they're thinking, where do I start? What is the first thing you would start somebody off with in Puritan literature? First book, first Puritan book they've ever read. What would you tell them to read?
I'd probably ask them what are they looking for? If they're looking for theology, I'd say read the Christian Focus book by Thomas Goodwin on Christ Set Forth and the Heart of Christ in Heaven. Mm-hmm. Still my favorite book. But then a sermon series I preached, I basically plagiarized from John Flavel, and I let my congregation know, and I couldn't believe the evening services were packed because I was talking about his book, Overcoming Fear, something like that. It's a reprint by Reformation Heritage Books, one of the best books on overcoming fear. It is the best book I've read. So those little paperbacks that Reformation Heritage Book, Christian Focus, I think Crossway and a few others do them, those would be the places to start, because they take basically a work out of those massive volumes and put it into modern day English. So look for those. But that one by Flavel would be the one to look for, and something by Goodwin as well.
That's great. That's really great. Let me give a plug, too, because, Mark, I don't know if you know this, but one of my former pastors, Jim O'Brien, he is starting a new publishing company called New Puritan Press, and he is taking long-forgotten Puritan works that, you know, even a lot of Puritan scholars would not be as well familiar with, and he's taking those and he's making them available in electronic format very affordably, and that should be coming out this month. So I just wanted to throw that out there because there are a lot of companies, like you mentioned, Reformation Heritage and Banner of Truth and these other publishing companies that are taking small discourses and whatnot, as you said, that are tucked away in the works, and they're republishing them. So,
great.
Well, there's so much to think about. And this book just sparks so much interest and provides for a much lengthier reading list or to-do list, because once you start getting into it, you want to read and read more and learn more. But I want to commend the book to people. Again, A Puritan Theology, Doctrine for Life. You can visit Reformation Heritage Books online at heritagebooks.org. There you'll find a number of titles that you're going to want to pick up, but you can pick this book up, and we would encourage you to do so. But Mark, I want to thank you so much for all of your work and also for taking the time today to discuss these this topic with us. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thanks very much, guys. It's always a pleasure, and I appreciate it. And I know that Joel also appreciates you having me on so that we can get the book at least known a little more. And it will be, I think, available October 11th on shelves is what I'm told. So
great, great. Well, we look forward to that. Of course, you can visit Mark online at meetthepuritans.com, but also I believe the church website is faithvan.com. Is that correct?
It is.
This is not a van that comes to your house, right? This is for Faith Presbyterian Church, Vancouver, I believe.
It depends how much money you have. We need a new church building, so if you have money, we'll definitely drive over.
It's not like Web Van where they tried to deliver groceries to your house, and this time they deliver the gospel.
Yeah. Well, we just pick up money.
Okay. That works too. Meet the Puritans, Puritan Theology, all sorts of great things from Mark Jones. So keep an eye open for more on that. We'll have links in the show notes. Jim Cassidy, you can find his church at calvary-amwell.org. A lot of great things going on there. Of course, Nick Batzig at feedingonchrist.com. The new program, East of Eden, available at our website. And, of course, his church, newcovpres.com, New Covenant Presbyterian Church. Jared Oliphant, a lot of the fruits of his labor, especially as a communications manager, is available at wts.edu. And to round off our list of things to go visit is reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs, and you'll be able to stay up to date with everything that we're doing. If you'd like to get a hold of us, email us at mail@reformedforum.org or follow us on Twitter @reformedforum. I want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.